My name is Kim, and I'm an alcoholic. And could we have a moment of silence and gratitude for AA recoveries of the past 75 years? And at this time, without further ado, I would like to introduce Irma V. from Saskatchewan.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Irma, and I am an alcoholic. And when I was asked to speak at first, the first feelings were really nervous and really afraid, and then I remembered where I was coming, and it's just a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then it's in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that I got a little bit of peace and serenity, and you've taught me how to live, and you've given me everything I have. So now I just get to give a little bit back to you, I hope. Before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I sure didn't know what peace and serenity was. I lived in a home where there was a lot of chaos, a lot of instability. And not that my parents didn't do the best that they could. My mom was an alcoholic, and she had her own journey. But before she passed away, we were able to spend a year of sobriety with her. And she ended up in a treatment center, and it's like it gave us a mom that we never would have known. And she always, I believe, tried to be there for all of us and to show us that she loved us even when she couldn't. And we grew up with the Serenity Prayer on our wall. And you know, as things happened, when she sobered up, I was really, really happy to no longer have, you know, that bottle of beer sitting on the counter and not knowing where she was going to be and the fighting between my mom and dad and the things that went on. And I swore I was not going to be like that. I wasn't going to take those drinks and I wasn't going to let alcohol run my life. Because, see, I still thought there was a little bit that had to do with willpower. And that it was a choice that we had whether or not we became alcoholic. And I learned firsthand that's not the way it was. When I was really young, I hear some people say, you know what, the first drinks were whenever. And all I remember is sneaking drinks when I was really young. I remember being 8 years old and being given a shot of Bacardi when we were out fishing so we didn't get pneumonia. So it's medicinal. And wanting more. And someone else making sure I didn't get more. But the very first time when I was 14 years of age and I went to a wedding party and there was nobody there telling me how much I could drink, I got totally blitzed. And did all those things that I thought I would never do, like getting sick and it was just horrible. And not remembering how I got home and not remembering a lot of stuff. And later hearing about some of the things that I did and things that took place. And I thought, that's never going to happen again, right? And but I was on a search, and I was on a search for something to make me feel better inside. I hated who I was, I hated how I felt, and I had a football in my gut. And the only thing that I knew that would take that away was drink. And then down the road, though, you know, when alcohol quits working for us, and then what do? You know, I was at that jumping off point that it talks about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to live. But I didn't want to die. And I didn't know where to go. And I started praying for help. And I just started praying for something to take that feeling away. Something to take that pain away. And thank God I was married to an alcoholic. I knew he was alcoholic. And I thought I knew what he needed, right? Because he drank every day and he did those things that typical alcoholics did. I was a binge drinker, and I gotten to the point where I couldn't drink. When I drank, I got so physically ill, I couldn't drink anymore. And so that's when I wanted to die. And he got a choice between jail or treatment, thanks to a fourth impaired. God works in mysterious ways. And we ended up having a choice of going to a treatment center that had a spousal program. And I went, because I was looking for an answer, you know, but I thought it was all his fault. Right, if only he sobered up, everything would be fine. And I found out in there after 2 weeks of being in treatment, thanks to a guy who'd been sober for 5 years and on a dry drunk, who talked about how he felt, I found out that those feelings were part of alcoholism. And that all that time when I had been searching for something to make me feel better, it was because I was an alcoholic. And that I needed a program of recovery. And that I wasn't just crazy, that there was somewhere that I could go and something that I could do that I wouldn't want to die anymore. And I wouldn't be full of fear anymore. And you guys showed me that path. And I still remember sitting at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there was a guy there by the name of Gary, and I've never seen him since, but he had such an impact on my life. And I'm so grateful for those people that visit treatment facilities and that do those things to carry the message into corrections and into wherever, because that's where I heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he talked about, you know, all I needed to do was believe in a higher power, read my big book, and go to meetings on a regular basis, and I wouldn't want to die anymore. And I hung on to that. And even when I you know, after when we got home or whatever, and those that football in the gut would come back and that pain would come back and stuff, and I just remember them saying, you know, it's like a thread and you just hang on, and it's like a string, and you go to a meeting, and afterwards you still have a choice. You can drink if you choose after, but go to that meeting first. And I went there, and I started to look there for something to make me feel better and to give me some of that peace and some of that feeling of contentment that I'd searched for my whole life. And it's through Alcoholics Anonymous that I got that. And I heard this morning, and it's so true, you loved me when I couldn't love myself. And you gave me a hope when I didn't have a hope. And you gave me the tools that I needed as long as I work this program to the best of my ability and the 12 steps that are laid out in front of me, that I have a chance today to find some of that peace and serenity. And every time that I'm not right with the world and that I'm starting to think about what's wrong with you and what's wrong with the world and everybody in it, I'm really grateful for my sponsors and for sitting around the tables where they got me to turn around and take a look at me. And when there's something wrong with you, what's wrong with me? What is it in me that's making me be intolerant of you? Why am I not accepting you for who you are and not accepting life on life's terms? And it's not, you know, that life has been peachy and whatever since I've come into Alcoholics Anonymous. There have been some ups and some downs. I've went through a divorce and I've been through some losses and some family members and stuff. But my circle of friends continues to grow. And I'll share something after. I was going to go into it, but I'll wait. One of the things that my sponsor always shared with me when I would phone and whine and complain about my husband, about things that were going on in my life, and I just want to read this, and I'm sure many of you have read this many times. It used to be on page 449 in the third edition, and it's on page 417. And it's my favorite part in the big book. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I'm disturbed, it's because I find some person, place, or situation, some fact in my life unacceptable to me, and I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it's supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Until I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. Unless I accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world as on what needs to be changed in me and in my attitudes. And that really sums up, you know, where life has been for me and where I've really had to focus. And it's through working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, by getting involved in service, by doing the things that were suggested to me, that I've been able to find, like I said, that little bit of peace and serenity. I used to think happiness was on the outside, and if I could just arrange certain things a certain way, and if I could have things happen in a certain way, that would give me a happiness that I had was striving for. And there's been times in Alcoholics Anonymous where, and it was so obvious the first time it happened, where I was standing in a backyard under some oak trees and my kids were playing or whatever, and everything on the outside wasn't the way I necessarily would have had it happening. I was actually going through my marriage breakdown and stuff and just whatever. But at that very moment, in that moment when everything on the outside seemed like it was in chaos and in disturbance or whatever, that feeling inside was that I was just at that right place at that right time as God would want me to be. And that he was going to take care of everything and that everything was going to be okay if I could just turn everything over to him. And that's how it's been since I've come into Alcoholics Anonymous. If no matter what's happening, if I can turn it over to my higher power, who I choose to call God, I just feel like everything's going to work out the way it's supposed to and that everything's going to be okay. Step three, where it talks about turning our will and our life over to the care of God. One of the hardest things that I had to do was to turn my children over. It's like I could trust you guys and that you were going to keep me sober and that you were going to take care of me. But what about my kids? You know, there'd been a lot of deaths and stuff, and I'd had a sister die in an accident. And even before we came here, I said the step three prayer and the serenity prayer with my kids and with my boys. Because I know that I can't be there 24 hours a day and I need to be able to believe that they're going to be okay and that whatever happens is what's meant to take place now. And we have a couple boys, and when you got both parents that are alcoholic, what are the odds that one of them isn't going to possibly have this disease, right? And so when they get in trouble, when they screw up or mess up as I did, I actually thank my higher power. Because I didn't get here because everything was peachy and king and everything was just fine. I got here because of the trials and the tribulations and the pain. And the more pain they feel at a younger age, I pray that they find the doors to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I pray that each one, every one of us will do whatever we can to keep these doors open. And when we're asked to serve, that, you know what, if we can and we're open and we're willing, that we'll put our hand up and say, yeah, I'll do my part. I'll do what I can to ensure that Alcoholics Anonymous remains here for those people yet to come. And I just wanted to, where my mind went just before we got here, actually in the last couple weeks, is when I was thinking about the topic that I was asked to share on peace and serenity. If anybody looked at our life on the outside, they would really wonder possibly what I had to share on this topic. I've used the serenity of prayer a lot, the step three prayer. We've just had a really busy life, and I have a really busy life. And I believe what people have told us is if we're open and we're willing to serve, that God will make it possible and take care of everything else in the meantime. And many times I get really busy, and sometimes in my family life and in my home life, things will get put off thinking, you know what, we'll do this down the road or next year when we're not so busy. And I'm really privileged in last year and this year to be able to serve as delegate for Area 91. And one of the things that came about is I got engaged last year, and it's something that I thought would never happen again. And it's to a fabulous man in this program and stuff, and somebody who I've known for a long time. And anyway, we set our wedding date, and I thought. Maybe we should wait till after I'm done all the delegate reports, and maybe we should wait till after, you know, and this fall. And I was at the conference this year, and my guest, she got sick, and we didn't know what was up and stuff, and it really had me thinking, you know, about all we have is one day at a time. And if we believe, or for me anyway, if I believe that I'm doing the things that are in front of me and that are meant to be, again, trusting that my higher power will help things to work out the way that we're supposed to. We just got married last weekend. And this is our honeymoon. And we wanted to share it with you guys because you guys gave us everything that we have. And I had a son that graduated. We had a son that graduated on Wednesday night, stayed up at Safe Grad, and I was going to write out what I was going to say here today as they were all partying and having their drinks. And all I could do was sit there and just be really, really grateful for everything that we have, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, so thank you.
you, Irma, for sharing your recovery with us. That was great. And next up, from California, we have Dre. Come on down.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dre, and I am an alcoholic. I have my little stopwatch here. I've been known to be the 20-minute, 10-minute speaker before. So, they said, don't go over. How are you? How is everyone? You know, this room is really filled up since the meeting started. I just want to say to those of you that how I'm feeling right now is I couldn't be here if I hadn't been there. To be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the International Convention, this is my fourth one, and to be speaking is a little overwhelming. My sobriety date is June 19th, 1989. I just turned 21 last month. I had a sponsor once that said, to be able to stay in the middle of this program, you need four things. Four things. You need to have a sponsor, and he needs to know he's your sponsor. My sponsor's right here. His name's Emil C. Raise your hand, Emil. C, he exists. You need to have a home group. My home group is the traditional group in Sacramento, California. We have 23 meetings a week. And over 300 members, and if you're ever in Sacramento, please drop by. We'll try and make you welcome. You need to know what step you're on. I'm always on 6 and 7, but I think technically I'm on 8 right now. And you need to have a commitment. And I, too, have had a lot of commitments, but I'm also in general service. I serve as the Panel 60 alternate delegate for California Northern Interior Area. And that's my story. You know, I used to think that I was an alcoholic because I drank a lot. I used to think I was an alcoholic because I watched my father drink himself to death at the age of 46. I was 19 and he was brain dead. And he was brain dead because he had liver and kidney failure. And he was dead because the doctor came to my mother and said, your husband's brain dead, you need to make a decision. And I know that this is an inherited disease, and I thought, well, maybe that's the reason I'm an alcoholic. Maybe I'm an alcoholic because I was dyslexic and I couldn't read, and everybody thought, we didn't have words like dyslexic in the 60s when I grew up. We had words like stupid and dumb. I started noticing early on, by the time I got to the first grade, I was pretty normal until I got in the first grade. And I suddenly noticed that the kids that I played with across the street, when it came time for reading and spelling, you know, it's Dick and Jane and C-Spot Run, they were on one side of the room, and I was on this much smaller side of the room with the fewer people that we all lovingly called the paste and booger eaters. Those were my people. Those were my people. And so I felt different, and I thought that that might be the reason I was an alcoholic. I didn't have sisters, so I was kind of scared of girls, and I thought that might be the reason I was an alcoholic. And then one day, and those of you that picked up the commemorative edition of AA Comes of Age, I read the Tebow papers, and Harry M. Tebow was one of our first trustees. He was a psychiatrist. I think he was Marty M.'s psychiatrist and perhaps Bill's at time. And he wrote this article for the American Journal of Psychiatry in January 1944. And in here, he describes me. Maybe he just doesn't describe you, but he describes me. He says, despite most reports to the contrary, there is a growing recognition of certain common qualities which are regularly present in alcoholics, excepting those who have a frank underlying mental condition, meaning crazy. Characteristic of the so-called typical alcoholic is a narcissistic, egocentric core dominated by feelings of omnipotence and intent at maintaining at all costs its inner integrity. While these characteristics are found in other maladjustments, they appear in a relatively pure culture in alcoholic after alcoholic. In a careful study of a series of cases, Silman reported that he felt he could discern the outlines of a common character structure among problem drinkers, and the best terms he could find for the group of qualities noted was defiant individuality and grandiosity. In my opinion, those words were accurately chosen. Inwardly, the alcoholic brooks no control from man or God. He, the alcoholic, is and must be the master of his destiny, and he will fight to the end to preserve that position. So I'm an alcoholic because nobody could tell me nothing for a long time. I got sober at 32, and I didn't get sober because the fiancé that loved me, who had already had the ring and the dress, asked me to stop drinking and said, "Dre, I can't watch you drink yourself to death." I didn't get sober because my youngest brother, who was 11 when my dad died and who was my roommate, was begging me to stop, who thought I had already crossed the line and couldn't come back. I got sober because my boss at the time, I'm one of those people that got sober through his work, she said, it's interesting, she'd had other conversations with me, conversations like, "Dre, there's a little odor of alcohol about you. Did you have anything to drink last night?" And you know, you'd polished off a pint or a fifth or a quarter, whatever it was, but you did this Academy Award looking act like you had to think about it. "Did I have a drink last night? Let me think." Or you do her best to look at her like she was crazy, like she just said, "There's Martians in your backyard." And you go. And those of you that ever drank before, after work, or tried to deal with people, you know how we all have our little personal space that's a couple of feet around us? Mine was about 10. Because if you got any closer, you might smell the alcohol vapor that I felt was pretty sure was coming out of my eyeballs. So one day she sat me down after a meeting I'd been to where people had invaded my personal space. And apparently they'd been talking about me. I'm not one of those people that once I got sober, people go, "Really? I never knew you drank." I wasn't one of those. Instead, they'd been talking about me. And the thing they said was, "Dre," and it was amazing. She didn't say, "Dre, do you think you have a problem?" She didn't say, "Dre, we think you have a problem." She said, "Dre, we know you have a problem." And there isn't a shame in having a problem. There's a shame, though, in having help available and not taking advantage of it. That was me. And at that point, you know, I'd already had those kind of drunken conversations you have with yourself at a mirror where you've got the neon L on your forehead about being what a loser you are and how many opportunities have slipped through your fingers, and no wonder nobody loves you and nobody listens to you. And so at that point, that was my first half of the first step. I gave it up. The AA police had been after me, and I turned myself in and trundled off to a treatment center. And I'd love to tell you it's been all great since then. But, you know, I'm not one of those people that had a problem with a higher power. But I saw the words in the steps, and I got scared. And the reason I got scared wasn't because I didn't believe, but I didn't believe that I could have a higher power that believed in me. I didn't believe that I could have a conscious contact. And luckily, my counselor at that time, this was really insightful. He said, "Dre, no one's ever been too stupid to get this program, but a lot of guys have been too smart. So if I were you, I would think less and listen more." That helped a lot. So I came out of a treatment center, and I got to tell you this story. I was in Sacramento just before coming up here, and I talked to a friend of mine, and we're both of the class of 89. And the story is this. The first time I experienced serenity, I almost drank. I remember it clearly. You know how I used to get these like waves of depression that would come over, which was my mind trying to kill me. And saying, you know how to get over this. You know what you need. Just us, buddy. These other people mean well, but, you know, we know. So I'm sitting there, and I was, like, all depressed. And I had, you know, I lived in Sausalito, California at the time. It was gorgeous. The sun was blue. The water was purple. I'd been out to this street fair. I was wearing clean clothes. I had made the bed, and I was depressed. So I did the next right thing, and I started doing the dishes. And I remember, you know, I'm doing the dishes in the sink, and I got those funky yellow gloves on. And suddenly, I wanted to drink so bad, I had to grab the side of the sink to keep my legs from buckling. And I thought, why do I want to drink right now? And the answer came instantly. Because you're an alcoholic. And that was one of those things, like sort of a good news, bad news. It's sort of like a scratch that itches, you know. It's like the bad news is you want to drink. The good news is there's a reason for it. And then I thought, well, why do I want to drink right now? You know, I've got this beautiful day. I've got, you know, the no bill collectors are calling. I'd had a gorgeous day. Nothing's wrong. I had a moment of serenity, and that was what was wrong. It didn't feel right. And I called my sponsor, or who passed for a sponsor in those days. And we kind of talked about it. And in my experience, the times that I have wanted to drink most have almost always been when things are going good. I know how to handle cruddy. When things are going cruddy, I'm your guy. Because I know what that feels like. But when things are going good, it makes me feel uncomfortable. So I had to learn over a period of time how to feel comfortable with serenity, how to feel comfortable in peace. I kind of trundled on for a few years, and at seven, I don't know any of you that have had this experience, but suddenly life gets better because you can show up to work on time. Have you noticed that? Somebody says, it's really odd, they say, can you be here at such and such a time? And before you used to go, I don't know, what time of day would it be? You know? Depends on how many drinks I'd had by then. Depends on whether I was sober or if I had some in the morning. How many people used to hide bottles in your house when you lived by yourself? You know? Yeah. So things are going better, you know? I'm getting to work on time, you know. If people say, can you do this? I'm like, sure. My spelling improved a lot. I could read my own handwriting. And on the other hand, I hadn't jumped into the steps. I hadn't jumped hard into the steps. And the only reason I started doing the steps was because, you know, how a lot of my meetings were in the meetings before the meetings, you know, where you're smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee in church vestibules. And my sponsor at the time said, you know, I lived in Sausalito. He said, you know, guys that don't do their fifth step by the time they're five go mad. And I was feeling a little fidgety. So I thought, I better do that. And I did. And I didn't feel like this great weight lifting, but I felt like, okay, I'm going to keep going. And yet I never dug down to really get into the feelings. And I started to recognize that what takes the place of alcohol is busy. I can be busy. I can be doing stuff. And I don't have to feel things. I don't have to have. I'm not peaceful. I'm not serene. But I'm in service. You know? At the time, I was moving, I was changing jobs, my dad had passed away, he was an only child, my grandmother, I was moving her from selling her house to the board and care to the convalescent home. I was dating a lot in AA, so God knows what was going on there, but it probably wasn't good, you know. I was going back and forth, and my sponsor looked at me and he says, "You're like Ricochet Rabbit, Dre. You are bouncing everywhere and you're touching the surface of everything and you're not creating depth or serenity in any of those things." And I had to start the steps over. And I had to start them with a sponsor who could take me through them and say, "Okay, one's checked off. Now two's checked off. Now three's checked off." And it got me back into the spiritual part. It got me back into that bit of prayer. And I learned to pray and things got better. And over a period of time, they keep getting better, but I can get busy. I get the bad case of the I knows. Yeah. Don't tell me, I know. That's good for you, but I know. I'm a special case. So I had the bad case of the I knows one day, and I'm sitting actually with Emil, who was at that time my service sponsee, and I was drawn to what he had. I was drawn to his demeanor. I was drawn to his sense of calm. I said, "Would you walk me through the steps?" He said, "Sure." Now, Emil and I relate to each other in that we both have worked in consulting. So little did I know that I would get a binder with pages, that I would get homework, that I would not only keep a journal, but I would have things to turn in. And you know what? I respond to all of that. Because if you are ever sitting there with a bad case of the I knows, write it down. Write it down like you're going to tell somebody what's in your head. And then when you start to see it, you go, "That is whack. That's crazy. Why did I think that was a good idea?" My sponsor teaches a prayer and meditation class. So I have homework. But I wake up every morning, and in addition to prayer, I've learned to meditate. And for those of you that haven't gotten there, and why would you be at a Peace and Serenity meeting if you hadn't gotten here yet? You learn that prayer is asking and meditation is listening. But it takes quiet to hear it. And it takes quiet to hear the I knows go away for some new ideas and some openness to it. So my sponsor on my 21st birthday gave me a book. The book is called Drop the Rock. I don't know if any of you have heard it, but it has a prayer I'm going to leave you with. It's called the Set-Aside Prayer. It says, "Lord, today help me to set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, and everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about my recovery. Instead, let me be open to a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, and in my own recovery. Thank you very much." Is that all right?
Thanks, Dre. Yeah, I remember the first time I got a little peace and serenity in my life, I thought I was bored. I wanted it, but I didn't know what it was going to be like. You know? I really like it now. You know, I could just slip into a coma at a moment's notice sometimes. It's great. So our final speaker today is a gentleman from South Carolina. We've got Herman R. And Herman, you got a little bit of time.
My name's Herman Robinson. I'm an alcoholic. And first thing I need to do, I need to thank God for all he's given. Then I need to thank God for all he's forgiven. See, I'm here because of how power I choose to call God, so I feel that I receive mercy instead of justice. See, by all rights, I should be incarcerated in somebody's prison, but through God's mercy and grace, I hold the highest honor you can hold in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sober. You know, the thing is, that's my delegate there with the second row. He didn't sit on the front row because he knew he would make me nervous. And the thing is, it's right there something. And the thing is, I can remember when I received this thing in the mail, and it talked about peace and serenity. First, let me tell you, I do have a sponsor. His name is Jim Tyson. My home group is the Grove Road Group in Greenville, South Carolina. And my sobriety date is July the 28th, 1985. By the grace of God, I've only found it necessary to take this journey to that time. See, I'm so bad in Greenville, South Carolina, they sent my friend, one of my home group members, her sponsor came all the way from Michigan to make sure I didn't lie, so I tell Martha I was okay. You know, I sit there, and one of the amazing things, God's been doing for me what I couldn't do for myself a long, long time. See, my mother was not alcoholic. My father was not alcoholic. Because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, all I needed to do was concentrate on me. I'm not going to give you a drunk log, but in chapter 3 of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it sums up me real good. It says most of us have been unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics. It says no person likes to think he is bodily or mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is a great obsession of every abnormal drinker. It says this, the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. Then it says, I had to fully concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. That is the first step of recovery. The delusion that we're like other people, present maybe, has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. That's me. You know, I sit there, and the thing is, if I live to see January 31, 2011, I would have had the same job 39 years, been out of work 32 days, and 28 days I spent in a treatment center debating whether I was like you. See, I didn't lose the house, the car, the job, the wife, the financial problem. I just didn't like me. So in 1985 in Greenville, South Carolina, there were very few people of color in Alcoholics Anonymous. So the thing is, I peeped into one at the first meeting I went to. And I know there's a God, and he's alive and well, for I walked in those rooms, and that lady with different pigmentation of skin came up and put her arms around me. She told me she loved me. And the only time I feel that love is in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's real. Now, I don't want anybody to spend their first 13 months in Alcoholics Anonymous like I did. I didn't drink, but I suited up and I showed up. And not one time did I take a checkup from the neck up while I'm here. But there's a gentleman, he's dead. His name is Henry Wellerman, who had the dash to do something my mother and father refused to do. See, I went to night meetings. 5 minutes later, I was there. 5 minutes after nine, I was gone. And I remember he cornered me one day, and he said, Herman, if you're so unhappy in Alcoholics Anonymous, he suggested I go out and get good and drunk. And he said, if you're fortunate enough, you'll make it back. What I understand it. What happens in these rooms. And I wanted to kill him. You call sponsors and they will give you some crazy suggestions. Like pray about it. There's something I read, and I believe in the power of prayer, because on page 164 of the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, I read it every day, and it says, our book is meant to be suggestive only. It says we realize we know on a little. It says, God will constantly disclose more to you than us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do for the man who is still sick. It says, the answers will come if your own house is in order. It says, but obviously you can't transmit something you haven't got. It says, see, that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. You know, this thing in serenity, when I was I had to get the dictionary. I'm not rocket scientist material, but I had to get the dictionary because I wanted to make sure I knew what the hell I was talking about for once in my life. And I looked up the word serenity, and the first word came out as serene. Then I looked up serene, and it talks about without quarrel. It talks about calm, and it talks about quiet. Then I looked up the word peace, and it also stated without quarrel, and it talked about being serene. I don't know about any of you, but when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, my life was in disarray. There was a lot of chaos and confusion. You know, I sit there, and then the thing is, I got to thinking about all these things about that pertain to serenity. Then every meeting I went to, they say the serenity prayer. I don't know how many times I said it, but look what it says. It says, God grant me the serenity. So if I don't have serenity, I'm not going to accept what goes along with it. It says, accept the things I cannot change. You know, then the thing is, it says there, and I bought the book because my sponsor says if I don't become a student of the book, I have to co-sign everything shared in the meetings. See, in my opinion, this is proven recovery. On 452, it talks about serenity. It says, my serenity inversely proportional to my expectation. It said, the higher my expectations, the lower my serenity. Do I have expectations? The thing is, I came here and I was born in San Antonio, Texas. And the thing is, I'm staying my brother, and my brother drank. And my expectation was how he going to react because he knows that I'm sober. And I chose to live with him. And the thing is, when he came to pick me up, the thing is, my serenity was kind of high and I was kind of jittery and all this. My expectation was high and I was real jittery. And we got in his vehicle and we started to his house. And he said, we need to stop by the store. And we stopped by the store, and he bought a case of Big Red Sodas. And I said, you're not drinking? He said, one day I went to the mirror, and he said, the thing is, alcohol was causing problems in my life. And he said, for 5 months, I've been taking a look at it. Truly amazing what happens. But on the bottom of page 452, it says, my serenity is directionally proportional to my level of my acceptance. One of the things I like about the word acceptance, it doesn't mean you like it. It means that's just the way it is. You know, the lady said it, and the thing is, I use things other than the first 164 pages. I look in the stories because the thing is, God inspired these people. It's just like that acceptance. It says, acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. It says, when I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, some place, some thing, some situation, some fact of life unacceptable to me. And it says, and I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation is being exactly the way it's supposed to be at that moment. It says, nothing, absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake. It says, until I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. It says, until I could accept life completely on life's terms, I could not be happy. It says, I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world, but what needs to be changed in me and my attitude. You know, the thing is, my sponsor gave me a working knowledge of the 12 steps, and we talk about those nine-step promises, and there's one in there that says, we will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. But then it says, we will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. That was tough. That was tough for me. And that's why I start off and I say, thank God for all these forgiving. God has forgiven me. I will spend the rest of my life trying to find a way how to forgive myself. But see, I don't regret the past today. There's nothing about my life that I'm ashamed of. You know, I've heard some people say in this room, well, I want to change this and I want to change that. If I could take my life and put it on a slate board and erase everything that I thought was traumatic that happened in my life, more than likely I would end up with an empty board. I wouldn't need God. I wouldn't need 12 steps. And I sure wouldn't need you, Pete. You know, I sit there when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. My mother has 5 kids, and when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, she was real embarrassed. I was the only one she couldn't talk to the neighbors about. She called me up and she said, Herman, you got to go to school tonight. I said, yes, ma'am, got to go to school. Because I say, when I go to school, I don't go to jail, so I kind of like that. But you know, I sit there, and the thing is, I wish that I could tell you that my life has been that of just serenity and peace. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I said there were 3 things that could happen to me that possibly justify me picking up a drink. And 2 of them have already happened. I'm not a mama's boy. I'm a granny's boy. My grandmother was 4'10", weighed about 120 pounds, and she was Catholic by faith. And when everybody else stopped praying for Herman Roberts, she kept praying. In 1985, her prayers got answered. In 1994, she died. And it was real tough. It was real tough. But my God has strategically put people in my life, and he put them there for a reason. See, a lot of times we sit in this room, and we call folks old timers. You know, I was sitting in a meeting at 12 o'clock, Alcoholics Anonymous, and a young lady with 90 days looked over at me, and she said, Herman, do you think if you picked up a drink, it would bring your grandmother back? And the answer was no. And guess what? I went from a confused individual to sit there to understand what they talked about. Peace. January 16, 2001, 12:20 in the morning. I know it's 12:20. I have call ID, and it was my mother on the other end. They couldn't talk. It took me 10 minutes to drive from the apartment I lived in at that time. The bedroom light was on. The door was secure. I panicked. I broke the door in. Apparently, she had been eating a grape. It was lodged in her throat, and she was slumped over the bed, and she was dead. I called my brothers and sisters, and at 12 o'clock at the Alano Club, I was sitting in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I say these things because the thing is, I don't care where I go. If you're an alcoholic like me, you understand me. And I walked in those rooms, and I'm not one of those people that like to come and tell you my business. And I sit there, and for some reason it got out, and one of those God saints, young lady, 6 months, she looked at me and she said, Herman, how old is your mother? And I said, 73. She said, how old are you? And I said, 51. She said, your mother got to enjoy you for 51 years. She said, my son died at age 2. It took the edge off. And the thing is, that's what I find. This is the only place that I know that I can go and I can be me. Boy, the Joneses almost killed me. I don't know about y'all. Killing up them Joneses will kill you. All right, look here. On the way down here, I came with 2 of my friends. One's named Marcia and his wife named Marty. And they're from Boston. They talk funny, but you know. But you have to meet my friend Marcia. He's very special. He's a lot larger than I am, but he's real soft-spoken. And he's just a loving man. And I can say I love a man today. And we stopped in Mississippi. Gulfport. That was a time you couldn't get me to fly over Mississippi. But we stopped in Mississippi, and we went to a meeting, Ocean City, 8 o'clock. That's what we do. And all we did was walk in the rooms and say, we're alcoholics. And they said, welcome. You know, it's kind of like the one where it says, set a spell, take your shoes off. That's being comfortable. And I feel real comfortable. I didn't feel real comfortable for the last 2 days thinking about you people now. I should sleep real good tonight. And the more y'all kept coming, then I started seeing more people I knew. And I said, I mean, you can't tell no lie today now. You know, I want to share something with you. Not too long ago, somebody's always give me something. I think they think I need help more than anybody else. But they gave me a coin. And I buy them and I give them out because the thing is, there's a love. And this one says, serenity isn't freedom from the storm. It's peace within the storm. See, today I'm at peace. Today I can be what I did not want to be for 37 years. For 37 years I never wanted to be Herman Robb. It's kind of like what it says in the story. What I thought was the worst thing that could happen to me is truly the best thing that happened to me. It says that proves if I don't know what's good for me, I surely don't know what's good or bad for you. And I'm going to round this up because people just started looking at me and David pointing over there. And I don't know what that means, but I know my watch works. But I want to leave you this, and I sincerely mean it, that I don't want anything from you. If nobody has told you today they truly love you, I do. Because if it was not for the love of you people, God of my understanding, 12 steps, there would be no Herman Robinson. For that, I'll be eternally grateful. Thank you.